You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. In recent days, publishers across the media industry have responded to protests sparked by the killing of George Floyd by issuing statements of solidarity with demonstrators, calling for equality and an end to racial injustice. And at the same time, these media outlets, large and small, are laying off or furloughing journalists as their advertising dollars dry up. Where do you get your local news from? Do you have a local paper anymore? Do you trust the media? Is the press a polarizing force like politics? We're at 800-642-1234. Dan Kennedy is a professor of journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. He writes a weekly column on media issues for WGBHnews.org. Dan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Good to be here.
Well, we're seeing this juxtaposition right now. People are hungrier than ever before for news and information, and yet advertisers are drying up amid the economy. What is the magnitude of the damage you're seeing?
Well, it's pretty bad, and I have not seen a count since the New York Times did this some weeks ago, but as I think that you said in the promo, something like 36,000 journalists have been laid off, furloughed, or had their days cut. I shouldn't say journalists, employees of news organizations. So that would take in everybody since the COVID crisis began. And with the economy shut down, advertising, which had been declining for years, just fell off a cliff. And an important source of revenue to keep local news going suddenly was no longer there.
What kind of financial shape were these news outlets in prior to the pandemic?
Well, it really depends on what we're talking about. And since we're talking about local news, we should mainly be talking about newspapers. And they have been in crisis for years. However, the papers that are owned by corporate chains and hedge funds, such as those owned by Gannett, Alden Global Capital, and the like, were in much worse shape because those papers had been saddled with massive amounts of debt in order to satisfy Wall Street or satisfy their hedge fund owners. So they were in no position at all to withstand what suddenly happened to them in early March.
Where was this debt coming from? Where were they accruing the most debt?
Well, you'd borrow money to build your chain. And then the papers, which fundamentally might be reasonably healthy, would have to send a good share of their revenues off to corporate headquarters to pay down the debt. And this was debt that was incurred through the equity markets and that sort of thing. These were investment plays more than they were sources of journalism. And it was a high wire act to begin with. Everybody knew that these papers really couldn't withstand any additional trouble. And then the biggest trouble we've seen in decades came along. When you look at independent newspapers, the picture is somewhat different. We've seen some downsizing here and there, but on the other hand, we've seen some success stories, too. Here in Boston, the Boston Globe has done quite well by emphasizing digital subscriptions in recent years. And they had actually achieved profitability about a year and a half ago. I'm sure the profits ceased when COVID came. But nevertheless, they've seen their digital subscriber base go up to more than 200,000. A lot of that is based on heavy discounts, and the paper seems to be determined to try to hang on to those new subscribers when their discounts expire by leaving the journalism more or less intact. There have been a few minor cuts here and there. But for the most part, the Globe has been continuing to provide very comprehensive coverage of COVID and other stories. And that really seems to be the way to move forward. But you have to have local independent ownership that's able to withstand a storm like we've seen with COVID, and that is kind of determined to ride it out until things can get back to something approaching normal.
We're talking with journalism professor Dan Kennedy, talking about how the pandemic is changing the way media organizations operate. Did you have to pull your support from a news outlet due to COVID financial difficulties? Where are you finding your local news? What about social media? What information do you get there? And students, were you considering a career in journalism but now aren't sure if it's the right career path for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Dan, you know, we have here in Wisconsin a number of newspapers owned by Gannett. We saw the chief executive say that he would not take his salary until the crisis is over. What can you say about Gannett in terms of how it is positioning its papers and what you're seeing out of furloughs and layoffs?
Well, Gannett is the successor company to Gatehouse. Gatehouse essentially acquired Gannett about a year ago. And so Gannett has been around for decades, but it's really Gatehouse these days. And they have been determined for a number of years to just slash their journalism as much as they possibly can in order to eke out some profits. The Gatehouse-Gannett story was pretty grim even before COVID hit. And the pandemic has only made things that much worse for them. Unfortunately, the people who are really harmed by this are the people who work for Gannett, who make very little money working very hard, and the communities that they purportedly serve. Even before COVID, I live in a Gannett community. It's a diverse city of 60,000 people. We have a Gannett Weekly, and we have not had a full-time staff reporter in our city since last fall. So this predates COVID, and COVID has certainly made things that much worse, but it is only a continuation of the trajectory that they were already on.
Nonprofit newsrooms are launching at a pretty fast pace. What is this model and why is it gaining momentum?
Well, nonprofit community journalism has been an important part of the mix since around 2004, 2005. I actually wrote a book about one such project, the New Haven Independent, which is still going strong. It's a website and a community radio station, and it's actually the news source of record in New Haven, even though the Hearst paper there, the New Haven Register, is really not doing that bad a job either. Nonprofit news is insulated somewhat from what we're talking about because it's dependent on grants, foundations, the support of its audience. And even though foundations are wondering about their money, the fact is they've been able to sustain things better than for-profit newsrooms have been able to do.
Northeastern journalism professor Dan Kennedy, our guide as we discuss the state of the press this hour with your insights, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking inside the media industry here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's really an unusual dynamic going on where people are consuming the news like never before, but the devastation to the broader economy means that less journalists on the streets covering their communities. The Committee to Protect Journalists wrote a rare open letter Friday to all governors and mayors, police chiefs. It says, We write to you demanding that you take immediate action to stop the alarming number of assaults on journalists who are lawfully covering protests in your communities. What do you make of the press coverage so far? Are you concerned about attacks on journalists? Where do you find news about your community, and is it accurate? We're at 800-642-1234 to weigh in. We have Northeastern journalism professor Dan Kennedy as our guide. Dan, let's look a bit at journalists covering the protests and the violence. There is a danger to reporters in the field. How have you seen this by way of the pandemic and the protests?
Well, the assaults on journalists at the Black Lives Matter protests have been a pretty disturbing thing to watch. I should say that it's not an entirely new phenomenon. Josh Stearns, who is currently with the Democracy Fund, compiled this massive list of journalists who had been assaulted during the Occupy protests, which I guess are 9 or 10 years old at this point. But what we're seeing now in the degree of violence and the injuries that have been meted out and the deliberateness of it in many cases is really kind of unprecedented in my knowledge. We've had distinguished alumni of our program at Northeastern who've been assaulted. Probably most memorably, Tyler Blint Welch of the Wall Street Journal was a Northeastern journalism alumnus, was assaulted by police recently and tweeted about it quite a bit. And Tyler is African-American. And as we've seen, that puts him at additional risk at these protests. It's really a disturbing thing to see, and it's hard not to relate it to years of rhetoric from President Trump referring to journalists as enemies of the state and fake news and all that.
You've also been talking about the arrests of journalists and specifically the CNN news team that was arrested. What did you see there?
It was what was so shocking about that was that the entire thing was covered on live video and that the camera continued to roll even after it was on the pavement so you could continue to see it. But it was very interesting, wasn't it, that you could see the CNN correspondent who was Black and Latino very politely asking, "Where should we go? We'll go wherever you tell us to go." And they just arrest him anyway. And then we learned later that a short distance away, there was a white CNN reporter, and it was exactly the same scenario. Where should we go? We'll go where you tell us to go. And the police were helpful to him. There was no arrest. So we see journalists at risk in general, but unfortunately, we see journalists of color at additional risk.
We're talking with Dan Kennedy, professor of journalism at Northeastern in Boston, and you can join in. What do you think will happen as local news outlets close or furlough their reporters? What do you make of violence against journalists, and how do you see the news media changing as we move forward? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Dan, you know, when you look at the state of the country right now and what journalists are trying to cover, there are protests, there is the pandemic, and there are a lot of narratives that journalists are trying to chase down. There seems to be a lot of different storylines out there. And when you look at the protests in particular, there is the looting storyline, there is the actual demonstration storyline, and George Floyd. Are those two being intermingle at all, or do you see distinctions there?
Well, I think that in the very earliest days of the protests, there was a really unfortunate tendency on the part of many news outlets to meld the protests and the violence together and to allow the violence to overshadow the protests. And I know that some of our students were expressing quite a bit of frustration with the way that the protests were being covered, at least initially. I think that since then, we've seen greater separation. There's a better understanding that the people who were engaging in violence in almost all cases were not the same people as the thousands and thousands of people who've turned out to protest peacefully against racism and police brutality. So I think that one of the aspects of this that is worth keeping in mind is that when there's a lot of confusion and a story is just developing, the media struggle to make sense of that just as much as anybody else. And sometimes it takes a few days to follow the various narrative threads and separate those threads where they're appropriate. I think that we've seen the media doing a much better job after those first 2 or 3 days. And I should say, too, that there hasn't been as much violence recently. I don't think there's been much violence at all recently that I know of. That seemed to take place early on.
Let's bring in a call now. Ron is joining us. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, perhaps I have more of a comment that the guest could elaborate on. I have little or no concern about the coverage of national news in local newspapers. I think that we're well served by national outlets, whether that be the Times, the Post, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, and major electronic media. Where I'm most concerned and very concerned is the demise of local news as it relates to covering school boards and city councils and the various committees and commissions in cities. And I think that we're at a tipping point here if we have an inadequate number of local journalists who are covering those types of meetings where citizens are affected dramatically. And I should throw in county boards as well.
Ron, thank you for that. Dan Kennedy, what do you see there on more of a micro scale?
Well, this is actually my major interest as a researcher and a reporter. It's the fate of this really grassroots community journalism. And when we talk about corporations like Gannett and Alden Global Capital, that's what they're putting at risk. It's this real hyperlocal journalism that's at risk. Another problem with community journalism is that the culture has been nationalized. And so this tremendous interest in what's taking place nationally, I think that the rise of the Trump presidency probably has a lot to do with that. So not only are we losing coverage at this community level, but we're losing interest. And I think that news outlets, local news outlets that are going to survive and thrive, have to figure out a way not just to cover all of these local meetings, but to do it in a way that actually sparks interest and reimagines civic engagement in ways so that they start to attract an audience that had drifted away because they're so interested in what's taking place nationally. And it's a hard road, but we could talk about some efforts being made in that regard if you'd like.
What do you see there?
Well, I mean, I want to talk a little bit about a project that I visited recently. The last week before the pandemic, I spent in Mendocino County out in California. It's a rural county of about 90,000 people. And their coverage has been decimated by Alden Global Capital, which has cut the newspapers out there to absolute ribbons. Well, for the last few years, they've had a very small community website called the Mendocino Voice. It's just two people, these incredibly idealistic young journalists, who are doing an absolutely terrific job of covering the county. But what I thought was even more interesting is that after several years as a for-profit, they are putting in place plans to grow and to transition to cooperative ownership. It would be kind of like your local food co-op. Readers and staff members can become members of the co-op. And as a result, you take a news organization that's covering the community and actually turn it into kind of a community asset that people really feel a part of. It's just one project, but I think it's very promising, and I'm keeping an eye on it.
Talking with Dan Kennedy, who researches the media business as a professor of journalism at Northeastern University in Boston, with your insights on the press, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update with Dan Kennedy here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the nationwide protests over the killing of George Floyd and how the media is covering and framing developments, reporting on complex and fast-changing events like protests. Typically, they call for all hands on deck in the newsroom, but it's complicated by widespread furloughs. And then there's a U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. It's a database compiling everything from arrests of journalists and the seizure of their equipment to physical attacks. It's verified more than 300 incidents across 60 cities amid the protests. Journalists, we want to hear from you. What is it like to cover these events? What are your interactions like with police? What do you make of the way the media is covering the George Floyd protests? Join in, 800-642-1234. We have Northeastern journalism professor Dan Kennedy with us for the hour. Dan, let's focus now on the developments at the New York Times, which had recently published the column by Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. What do we know there about what happened?
Well, it's been quite a tangled story, hasn't it?
Yeah.
The editorial page editor, James Bennett, resigned on Sunday and has been replaced on an interim basis with Katie Kingsbury, who was his deputy, somebody I knew from her time at the Globe and somebody who I hold in very high regard. So we'll see if she's able to right the ship. It does seem like a number of things went wrong with this particular op-ed. For one thing, Bennett admitted that he never read it before it was published. I think that what shocked people about it was not that it expressed a conservative point of view, but that Cotton was essentially advocating violence by the military against protesters, which not only was rather shocking in and of itself, but a number of journalists at the Times felt that it put them in danger since they're out covering this. In addition to that, he made unsupported assertions. He said that Antifa is involved. There's no evidence of that. People are wondering, but there's no evidence of it. And he had just a couple of days before the op-ed was published, he put up a tweet that had been roundly condemned, in which he said that no quarter should be given to violent protesters. And that, of course, is a military term that means kill them all. And as a number of commentators on the left and the right pointed out, he was advocating a war crime. And yet, whoever edited Cotton's op-ed did not insist that he wrestle with that. They just let it go. I mean, it wasn't in the op-ed, but given that he had just said this 2 days earlier, I think that any good editor would have required him to deal with it. So you put all these things together, plus multiple controversies that Bennett had been involved in over the past couple of years and, frankly, not handled very well. And it seemed that the time had come for him to move on.
What what is the learning, you know, what do we learn from this? And what is morale like now within the Times and its staffers who were deeply, deeply troubled by what happened?
Well, I imagine that morale is quite good, given that their concerns were heard and acted upon within a matter of just a few days. What do we learn about this? It does seem that in some ways the Bennett hiring, even though he is an enormously talented person, was probably misconceived from the start, given that he kind of lurched from crisis to crisis during his time there. And maybe one of the things that we should learn from this is that when a top-level hire like that doesn't work out, maybe try to bring things to an end a little more quietly before they reach a crisis point, as they did in this case. And kind of a minor learning point is, you know, read the op-ed before you publish it.
Let's take another call now. Gary is with us from Iron River. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good morning, folks. It seems to me that the Times fiasco you've just been talking about and reported on in the news is just another indication that there is no interest in many of the major news reporting agencies to tell both sides of the story. If you have an op-ed, that is the opinion of the writer. And the place to argue about it is with other op-eds or with editorials from the newspaper. To stifle one side of the story, whether you like it or not, is hardly a free and objective press. Part of our problem is too many of the reporters are trying to report a story that is consistent with their political beliefs. And until that changes, we're in big trouble in this country.
Dan Kennedy?
Well, first of all, we're talking about the opinion section, so objectivity is not on the table here. I am not going to repeat the points that I just made about all of the problems with this op-ed. I will just point out that the Times has several conservative columnists. They have conservative outside contributors from time to time. And they rarely, if ever, set off this type of firestorm. So maybe rather than falling back on the familiar trope of, there goes the liberal media again, it is more useful to take a look at the specifics of this situation, which are rather different from, for instance, yet another conservative opinion column written by Times columnists such as Ross Douthat and Brett Stevens and Barry Weiss, all of whom are conservatives.
We're talking with Dan Kennedy about how the news media is changing and covering amid COVID and the recent protests over the death of George Floyd. Where do you primarily get your news? Do you lean on social media? How do you want to see sites like Facebook and Twitter regulating posted content? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dan, let's look at social media. Pew Research said that more than half of U.S. adults get their news from social media often or sometimes. How has social media shaped our broader media landscape?
Well, it's the 1,500-pound gorilla, that's for sure. Mm. And when we talk about social media, in almost all cases, what we're really talking about is Facebook. Twitter is mainly used by other journalists, even though it gets a lot of attention. But we in the media tend to think that everybody's on Twitter, and they're not. But they are on Facebook. When people say that they get their news from social media, of course, what they're getting is links. So what are they linking to? Are they linking to reliable sources of news and information? Are they linking to some sort of bot content? Are they linking to memes? So essentially what social media does is that it enables everybody to be their own editor. And if you're simply looking for stuff that always confirms your preconceived beliefs, then social media is a pretty bad place to go. Now, you mentioned regulation a moment ago. I wrote a column last week in which I suggested that Section 230, the law that allows social media companies to avoid liability for the content that users post on their sites, maybe ought to be suspended for any services such as Facebook that use algorithms to drive up engagement. Because what we know about those algorithms is the way that they keep users on the site is to feed them content that keeps them agitated and angry. And that in particular, I think has done an awful lot of harm and is responsible for a lot of the divisiveness in this country. So you just take that protection away from them. I mean, print newspapers don't have it. You wouldn't be telling them what they can and they cannot publish. You'd just be saying that if you're going to engage in these kind of practices, you're not going to have the get out of jail for free card that you've had with Section 230. And, you know, I honestly don't know how practical my idea is, but I think it's something that might be worth making part of the conversation.
Facebook recently started labeling state-controlled media in instances. Will that make any difference?
You know, these labels don't make that much difference. They really don't. I saw something posted recently. It was disinformation about COVID. And God help us, it was posted by a friend of mine who's a nurse. You would think she would know better. And there was the little I for information symbol there. And if you clicked on it, you would see that it came from a completely unreliable source of information. But it was kind of hidden away. Nobody clicks on the little I. I don't know. And when this stuff does get labeled as being disinformation, the reaction of too many people is that, well, they're just part of the deep state. I believe it anyway.
We're looking inward at the state of the press amid the pandemic, the protests that have rocked U.S. cities following the killing of George Floyd. We're looking at social media. Where do you get your news from? How much do you look at social media for updates? Should Facebook and Twitter police its posted content? Do you think the social media helps or hurts the spread of information? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Dan Kennedy. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The news industry watchdog Pointer had a headline last week. It went like this. The pandemic led to newsroom furloughs. Then protests started. Are reporters coming back? Who's left to document what's happening? Here is Cap Times government reporter Abby Becker capturing a moment from a protest late Friday night. Demonstrators in front of the state capitol remembering Breonna Taylor.
Happy birthday!
How has your newsroom handled the coverage of protests? Do you have the resources to do it? Still time, 800-642-1234. Dan Kennedy is with us. He studies the industry at Northeastern University. Let's take a call now. Martha is with us from Menominee. Hi, Martha.
Hi, good morning. Really enjoying the show. Could you ask your guest about the lawsuit? The American Civil Liberties Union has now instituted a class action lawsuit in Minneapolis on behalf of the journalists who were injured and harassed and, you know, given a hard time recently. And I'm wondering if this case does go forward and there is a financial hardship to Minneapolis, if your guest feels, you know, this will cause cities to have some financial skin in the game and start taking things more seriously. Just would like to.
Yeah, thank you, Martha. Dan Kennedy?
Well, you know, I have to confess that I am aware that the ACLU has sued the city of Minneapolis over the treatment of journalists, but I am not really familiar with the details of that. I do imagine that if municipal officials realize that they could be held financially liable for injuries suffered by journalists, then they might have a greater incentive to not allow their police forces to run rampant and go after journalists. On the other hand, it would seem to me that even without the ACLU action, some of these journalists who've been injured have a possible grounds for a lawsuit anyway. You think especially of the freelance photographer who had her eye put out in, I believe it was in Los Angeles. I can't imagine that she doesn't have some legal claim that she could make in any case.
What is the role of freelancers in the protests and the pandemic? How are news organizations handling freelancers?
Well, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag. I mean, on the one hand, you see some newsrooms are eliminating their use of freelancers because when they wanted to make cuts, that was low-hanging fruit. I said at the beginning of the hour that the Boston Globe, for the most part, has been able to avoid much in the way of cuts to the newsroom. But they did cut the freelance budget quite a bit because they have control over that. They don't have to deal with the union, and it was a fairly easy thing to do, unfortunately. On the other hand, given how decimated newsrooms have been, if you have freelancers who are willing to go out and put themselves in harm's way and cover the protests, then this is an opportunity for their work to be used. And they don't have any of the benefits or the protections that a staff reporter would have. So there are some downsides to that as well.
Let's go to Willem now in Colfax this morning. Hi, Willem.
Hi, good morning. You asked about our news sources and what we use for news sources. I like to get a pretty diverse news source. I think I like to listen to the foreign press. I listen sometimes to Radio Netherlands and the BBC newscast, both on public television and on the radio. And I like to listen to the PBS NewsHour because I feel like they deal with issues in depth. And when you watch, like, the network news, it's really only 20 minutes and maybe only 15 minutes, and a lot of it are just little snippets, and you don't get the details, and they don't often have experts on. And like PBS NewsHour usually talks to people in depth about issues, and I appreciate that. And I like to also get my news information sometimes from magazines like The Atlantic or The New Yorker or even Rolling Stone or different sources like that, or The Progressive from Madison, Wisconsin, and things like that. And I never listen to Fox News because I don't believe they're a legitimate news organization. I think they're too biased, and I think they're kind of like the mouthpiece of the Trump administration. It's the only place where he's usually interviewed by anyone.
Well, Willem, let's get Dan to respond there to how you approach how you take in news.
Well, those are all fine sources of information, but it also speaks to the problem that we've been talking about this hour, Kate, and that is that, and Willem, and that is, where does local news fit into this? We are intensely interested in national and even international news, but we live in communities, and who's telling the stories of those communities? And are we listening? Are we paying attention? I think that's really where the real crisis is. And I think that a lot of people listening to your list of news sources might say, gee, you know, those are all pretty liberal, maybe you should add a conservative outlet or two to your news diet. I think that would be a perfectly legitimate observation to make, but I would even more rather see you add some local news to your diet.
Willem, thanks. Dan, you know, the press is under a lot of scrutiny right now. NPR's Sam Sanders said, tweeted the most stinging truth of 2020 is seeing how unprepared the majority of newsrooms across the country are to adequately cover this moment. So, you know, at this moment, where do you see criticism in terms of how journalists are covering communities of color?
Well, you know, diversity in the newsroom has been a problem for generations. And we've seen a decline over the years of the Black press, which once provided a really important alternative to the mainstream. And we flattered ourselves in thinking that, well, we don't have as much need for the Black press anymore because African-American issues have gone mainstream. But there were still very few people of color in the newsroom. And it's an even bigger problem at the top ranks of newsrooms. So we do, in fact, see a lack of preparation in terms of diversity and leadership to respond to this moment. Although we didn't mention it, the top editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer just departed over a horrendously insensitive headline that said, "Buildings Matter Too." And the sense I got from the coverage of his departure, good editor, by the way, I've interviewed him, I think he's fundamentally a good guy, but the sense I got was that the nonprofit that owns the Philadelphia Inquirer said, you know what, we have failed to deal with the diversity problem forever. And it may be unfair to let this person go at this particular time, but we have to start wrestling with this. We have to have more people of color in the newsroom, and we have to have more people of color in leadership positions. This may be, in some ways, similar to the Me Too movement, in which you had top people in media being pushed out for their, in some cases, for their shocking behavior. And they were in some places replaced with women, which was a long overdue move. We may be seeing this happening in newsrooms over issues of race as well.
Well, thanks for your eye. We appreciate it. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Kate. I really enjoyed it.
Dan Kennedy is a journalism professor at Northeastern University in Boston, where he writes a weekly column on media issues for WGBHnews.org. If you missed any part of this conversation, you can stream it. Go to WPR.org/mornings. Coming up next, it is On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.